Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Sorry, I am laughing. So this is not because of your question, but you will have heard some building work going on in the background. My builder is just, I've got a window behind my camera, and he's just come up to me, sort of stuck his face against glass, breathed on it and done a little heart shape for me, which is why I'm so laughing. So I have no idea what question you just asked, because I was trying not to get distracted, but he's a builder who makes me smile.
Welcome to the Humorology Podcast with me, Paul Barros, and my glittering lineup of guests from the worlds of business, sport, politics, and entertainment, who are here to share their wisdom and their use of humour with you. Humorology is the study of how humour can dramatically improve every aspect of your business and your life. Humorology puts the fun into business fundamentals, increases the value of your laughing stock, and puts a punchline back into your bottom line. Please remember to like, subscribe, and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. My guest on this edition of the Humorology Podcast is a baroness, television presenter, and 5-time Paralympian. During her sporting career, she has amassed a hugely impressive 30 world records, 16 gold medals, 8 silver medals, and 4 bronze. On top of that, she's also won 6 London Marathon titles. After a racing career, she's continued to work for the betterment of sport, disability services and youth as a coach and as an independent crossbench peer in the House of Lords. She's also appeared as a presenter on BBC Wales, S4C and BBC One. She was awarded the BBC Sports Personality of the Year Lifetime Achievement Award in 2019. Frankly, she could probably be considered a bit of an underachiever. Tanny Gray-Thompson, welcome to the Humorology Podcast.
It's lovely to be with you. Thank you.
Well, I honestly could have gone on and on about your achievements. And I think you are the most decorated person we've ever had on the Humorology Podcast. So it's astonishing and fantastic. And I'm a huge fan of your work. But I want to go back to the beginning. You grew up in Wales with your parents and your sister, Sian. And you're on record as saying that your parents have been a massive influence on your life. Did that include humour? And was humour valued in your family?
Yeah, humour was valued in the family, partly as a way to deal with some things. You know, partly the way that I was treated as a disabled young person. I think, you know, both my parents were quite strong feminists. So I think some of the way that my mum was treated sort of probably as a woman, you know, so humour was always sort of around us. And I think, you know, we watched comedy growing up. But I think it's also some of the stuff that we watched in the 70s, you know, is kind of seen very differently now. We'd also have quite serious political discussions around humour and, you know, what was sort of okay, what wasn't okay. You know, there's a whole debate of, you know, it's one person's joke someone else finds offensive. And actually, I think with humour, there is a bit that it has to kind of touch a nerve. But we used to have discussions about it as well. So it was around me quite a lot.
So I'm interested because you say humour has to touch a nerve. Do you think humour is that tightrope whereby, you know, you may fall on one side or the other, but you don't know which way you're going to go?
I think it can do. Yeah, absolutely. You know, I remember watching some things, you know, as a child, where Sandy Richardson, who was a character in Crossroads, who was a wheelchair user, and there was a sort of joke, I can't even remember what it was on, about him being a wheelchair user. I remember being quite upset by it at the time. And then sort of look back a couple of years later and thought, okay, a bit old, a bit different view. You know, I still didn't think it was funny, but it kind of challenged your thinking on things. So I think sometimes humour can be just really funny, you know, crying with laughter, and you don't know why you're crying with laughter. And sometimes it can, you know, nudge. I mean, there's definitely things that I don't think are funny and I don't think we should make jokes about, but that's where it makes it quite personal. I then, you know, choose not to go and listen to those people.
Yeah, but presumably, being in the House of Lords, you would fight for their right to say it, would you not?
I mean, free speech, especially at the moment, is really important. And, you know, free speech doesn't mean to say you can say whatever you want, but also shutting down people's views, I think, is really quite dangerous. So, you know, on social media, I follow people I don't agree with, absolutely, because we've got to be careful. We don't live in this, like, really odd bubble where our views aren't challenged, because I think it's always good to reset, to listen to other people, to think, okay, what do I really think about this? So, I think there is an element of free speech, which is really important.
Well, that's really interesting, because that whole echo chamber thing of now, because of social media, you're only curated with people who you have agreed with, and suddenly, as you describe it, the bubble becomes smaller. Whereas if you want to learn, you have to be challenged, as you say, don't you? And do you think humour is an effective way of challenging things?
I use humour because in certain circumstances, it stops me getting really angry. And for me, it's trying to be, okay, what's the best solution? What am I trying to get to? Am I just trying to shout at somebody because they've said something that I find sort of upsetting? Mm-hmm. Or am I trying to do something where I shift their view? So I get quite a lot of people like you, you know, and it's the pointy finger and it's the vaguely pointing in the direction of my wheelchair. And I've had this at a gate line at a train station. It was like, people like you can't use the ordinary barrier. You have to use the wide barrier. And it's like, no, I fit through this one. And, you know, it's like, no, you have to use the disabled barrier. And then you kind of think, right, do I try and have this intellectual conversation about the barrier is not disabled? The barrier is the wide barrier for people who, you know, and you go, right, it's 9 o'clock at night, I'm not doing that. So when I ever get people like you, my response always is, what, Welsh people? Well, Welsh people can't do that. It's been rehearsed over many, many years, I have to say. And it's not off the cuff, but it gives me time to think about what my next response is going to be. And it usually gives that person a bit of sort of context of, oh, what have I just, it doesn't always, but kind of what have I just, oh, and it challenges it in I think mostly a positive way. Cause then people go, oh no, I didn't mean that. What you meant wheelchair users can't do. So yeah, I do use humor. Sometimes it doesn't always work. But for me, I have to, because otherwise the people like you comment, it hurts the wrong word. It annoys me. And it's like, what gives you, this is why I use humour, because it very quickly gets into what gives you the right to decide what capacity I have to do that. And it's usually about where my chair fits. Like, I know how big my chair is. I don't randomly drive my car down the street not sure whether I'm going to hit things or not. You know, my chair's the same. I know what I can fit through. So, that's why I use humour, because it can defuse the situation. I also, you know, I do a lot of public speaking. It's knowing when to use humour to get effect, because people do remember funny things, and when to not use humour to, you know, when you have to be serious. You know, and the one thing is, you know, I learned in the House of Lords, humour can work in the chamber, but humour doesn't work great in Hansard, which is, you know, how our, you know, I mean, now everything's recorded on TV, but when it's written down, it can read very differently. So you have to be quite careful about how you use humour in the chamber, because it's also there written down forever.
Well, yeah, and no one's going to put in Hansard little smiley faces beside it, are they?
You know? Or the reaction of the chamber. So there's real world funny and there's House Lords funny, and they are quite different things. Because I remember ringing my husband after a really long day and saying to him, oh, it was so funny today. And I told him and he was like, yeah, that's not funny at all. And it was like, oh, but it was like it was at the time. So there was a question on Gibraltar. And there's about 8 minutes where the minister has to, and everyone who stood up to ask a question had some connection with Gibraltar. And Admiral Lord West stood up and sort of made a joke about, you know, that he never lived in Gibraltar, but he used to be captain of a ship and he thought he'd nearly anchored it in the wrong waters off Gibraltar in Spain when he should have been in Gibraltar. And everyone in the chamber went, oh! And then as I tell Ian, he was just like, yeah, that's not so funny. So for me, there's definitely several versions of funny that I have.
I think that's brilliant. But what I go back to is that mirror you can hold up with humour. That you go, you mean Welsh people? That bit is brilliant because because they have to then go, oh, hold on, what do I think? And it reminds me, we had the lovely Joe Brand. I don't know if you know Joe. On the show, and I've known Jo forever because of our comedy backgrounds. But she said one of the most useful things you can do is have some heckle put downs in your back pocket, especially as a woman, because what it does is it just sort of startles people out of it, and they have to think. And I thought that's very similar to you going, you know, what do you mean, Welsh people?
So I'm treated different ways. One way is an ex-athlete, generally quite nice. One way is a parliamentarian, people like me or don't like me, and then as a disabled person. So I think it does help sometimes, you know, to think what you would say in certain... So I don't experience, you know, much misogyny in the House of Lords, but I experience it in my life outside. I mean, one thing I do try to channel is Michelle Obama. You know, when she said, when they go low, we go high. I do try to do that. And then I did have a moment a while ago where some older man was trying to be a little bit patronising to me. And he picked up my hand and stroked it and said, you know, oh, it's so lovely. He was being really patronising. And I said, oh, it's so lovely you come out because, you know, when it's cold, you have to be careful. And people around me laughed. And he laughed, and then I thought, oh no, that wasn't Michelle Obama, was
no,
it?
No,
you know, I wasn't rude, but it was like, oh, and he was stroking my hand and being really patronising to me, so it was a bit, you know. So I'm kind of thinking, okay, what would happen if that's something like that happened again? What would I do differently? But you see, you know, you have comedians on stage. You know, I always think when I talk about it, it sounds a bit rehearsed, but comedians are rehearsed, aren't they?
A lot of the time.
You know, they don't just go on stage and think, you know, they'll react to the audience and they'll say things, and, you know, one of the things, they can be very quick and, you know, clever, but you know, they do rehearse things and check what goes down and what doesn't go down.
Well, absolutely. And having spent 10 years at the Comedy Store, it suddenly reminded me of the line that I used to have in the back of my head, which was, I don't mean to patronise you. That means talking down to you.
Yeah, it's that's always an interesting one, isn't it? Yeah. I don't mean to be patronising.
No. Yeah, exactly. You often speak about discrimination and the barriers that people face, and you're a huge advocate for them in the House of Lords. Does that ignorance that you run up against, how do you get around that? Do you have to think to yourself, this is funny in a way? Do you have to... put it in a box, because we've just been talking about it, and I wonder how, because sometimes these things wound and stay with us. Do you have to just laugh them off, as it were?
Yeah, sometimes. And then I think you can kind of use it as an experience to develop as a person as well, in terms of thinking about how you need to kind of shift people's views. So I think that's a really interesting question. You know, it's quite deep actually in terms of how we react and how we interact with people and what we do in various situations. So, you know, there are some people you just go, do you know what? I had someone recently, I'd come out of a debate and was rushing to another meeting and I was going quite quickly and somebody stopped me and said, oh, you should do wheelchair racing. And then it's like, so they probably didn't know what my life was before. And you go, yeah, lovely. I'll think about that. You know, I've had a few people say to me, you know, when I'm getting rushing from eating, it's not a race, you know. And you go, what? You know? And so they think they're being really funny. They're not being mean. And, you know, what you can't say is, yeah, no, it's not a race because I'm not on a track. I'm not in my racing chair. I'm not wearing Lycra. And you go, no, because they're not, they... It's a bit like people, oh, so people think they're hysterically funny when they say, have you ever got done for drunk driving in that? It's not funny. And I've had it millions, that's me being a bit exaggerating, but I've had it a lot. And again, you just go, oh, no, I haven't. Because it's like, oh, do you know what? Because if they got the, do you realise how patronising that's not being kind back. So, yeah, it's interesting when people think they're being funny. And I'm sure I've done it. I'm sure I've said things thinking I'm being really funny and it's not. So I think, you know, it's you've got to give a bit of leeway with some of this stuff as well.
Yeah, and I think you've got a choice, haven't you? You've got a choice of being kind and going, oh, well done, fabulous. Or you can just be completely stony-faced and go, oh, that's original. Really... to get through life, and the whole Humorology project is about the lightness of interactions. Surely that's an easier way, isn't it? To go, ha ha, no, very well done. You know, like it's the first time you've heard it, really, which is tough, I think.
Sometimes you just haven't got time to deal with it, so it's easier to laugh it off. Than just to get out of there than you know, actually kind of have a deep discussion about feelings and, you know, how you'd be offended. You know, I do worry a bit about, you know, sort of upsetting people and people's ability to be upset by things. And that leads us to a whole different conversation about kind of resilience and how you build resilience into young people. And, you know, you get it in sport, you know, where... you know, for it sort of shifts and changes about, okay, we're not going to have competitive sport in school. But at some point, life is competitive. So how do you bring it in? But how do you bring it in the right way to develop resilience and skills and, you know, these different things? And they're really big, you know, there's not a binary answer to some of this stuff. There really isn't. So, you know, I try to, you know, there's lots that I choose not to be offended by as well, I think, because life's too short sometimes. To, you know, to sort of move on. So, yeah, you just laugh. You just go, yeah, oh, never heard that one before. And, you know, get away.
I think it's very interesting to talk about resilience because you're obviously a hugely resilient person who's achieved extraordinary things. Do you think humour aids resilience in that sense? And therefore, how can we teach it to the next generation, rather than just, you know, we're all going to get knocked. We have children pretty much the same age. Your daughter's 21 now, isn't it? Yeah, my son's 21 as well. And that whole thing about trying to wrap them in cotton wool and, you know, somebody says something nasty to you at school, which is meant to be a joke. What do you do? Do you encourage them to go home and cry or report it to somebody? Or do you build in them something that can be useful in life?
I mean, sport teaches you lots of resilience because I lost loads of races in my career. And so, but people remember the ones I won. So nobody ever lists the really big races that I lost. So I completely screwed up my 800 metre final in Athens and beaten for a number of years, world record holder, made a stupid decision about 90 metres in that cost me the race. Well, I say cost me, I might not have won anyway, but that absolutely was the nail in the coffin to me having a chance of winning. Nobody ever lists that in my list of accomplishments, but it's one of the biggest lessons I learned in sport. So, you know, you do have to, I get frustrated when people talk about overnight success. oh, such and such, you know, they've come from nowhere. And especially, I think, in the music industry. And they don't see that they've been to potentially stage school, or they, you know, were learning instruments or wrote their own music, or, and they might be young, but they did loads of it. Or sometimes there is this overnight success. But the reality for most people, it's like years and years of work. It's just no one knew about them. So, you know, I think sport in a way teaches you to kind of be used to failure. I don't know any athlete who's like won everything they've ever done. And you listen to someone like Michael Johnson talk about it and about his career in sport. And there's loads that he didn't win and then suddenly, you know, developed. And but people don't tend to want to hear about those things. And resilience, I think, is really important, because you do have to have a level of it. But you also have to find people around you you can talk to when things are hard. So it's you know, I've got a really close group of friends who are amazing, but, you know, when I want to have a rant about something, who will also say, you know, do you know what? You've overreacted a bit, or no, you haven't, or you haven't reacted enough. So I think that support makes a big difference. But I'd say, you know, humour and laughing with my friends is a really important part of my relationships with people.
Yeah. Why are we so drawn to people who make us laugh? What is it, do you think, that you know, you said you have effectively chosen your friendship group around making you laugh, but obviously, you know, supporting you in other ways as well. But why is it so important, do you think?
I think I'm quite an optimistic person most of the time, and I kind of need people around that will sort of say, you know, let's look forward. Let's learn from what we've done or what happened in the past, but let's look forward. I think I'd like laughing. It does make me feel better. You know, it's just, you know, in my working life, I deal with some really difficult things, and there's no humour in the difficult situation I'm dealing with. There is no, you know, some of the stuff I work in is quite frankly horrific and miserable, but you have to find a way of a coping mechanism for that. And, you know, I joke about, you know, sweets and coffee are my way through, but just having that chance to kind of step back and get a bit of space is kind of important to me. So, you know, whether it's through kind of watching TV or spending time with my friends or, you know, anything like that, it's important to have that kind of space, I guess, to just, you know, think differently about stuff, to reset. Because then when you're going back into, and I say sort of battle, but you're going back into a really tough situation, you've got the energy to deal with it. Because you need to, you know, some of the stuff I work in, you need a lot of energy, you need a lot of resilience, and you need to kind of, I don't really like the word self-care, but I can't think of a better one. You need to look after yourself to be able to go back in and do the things that you have to do.
No, I think that's true. And you said the words reset, and I was thinking while you were talking of what humour does is it kind of reframes it as well, doesn't it? It kind of, you look at it from a different angle. And so do you think that the truth goes down easier when it's got humour attached? I mean, with your friends, for instance.
Oh, with my friends?
No, well, generally in yes. life, I'm thinking, because with my friends, really, that if you ever get above your station, in inverted commas, they'll come and scythe you down beautifully so that the group stays together on the same level, you know.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. So with friends is different from work, very different. Sure. With my friend, I remember being in a debate, and it was a really deep, you know, quite challenging debate. And I'd spent a long time writing my speech, and I came out and I rang my sister and said, what do you think? And she went, you should brush your hair before you go in the chamber. and it sort of just broke the moment. I went, right, okay. And then she's like, right. And then we talked about, so kind of that break, because I sort of was quite intense when I said to her, like, what did you think? And so there's some stuff like that where, but I think you can use humour, you know, It's like, you know, if you're trying on an outfit that you desperately want to love, but you know you look really bad in, but you still want to love it. You know, a really good friend of mine, she's brilliant. They're just going, yeah, no. No, yeah. Do you want to look like, you know, you're 75 or, you know, I mean, to, you know, but she'll pick the tone that she'll, you know, she gets it sort of really right, which I think is important.
Yeah, it's that bursting the bubble, isn't it, of pomposity, which I think, and we can all get a little bit pompous in our own ways, you know, the importance of what we do and everything like that. And you need that leveller, really, don't you?
Politics is intense, you know, not all the time, or but you get, I mean, there's some really funny things that happen. So, you know, I haven't been an athlete. I'm not as skinny as I used to be. I'm really, you know, but I'm not training 12 times a week, 50 weeks a year anymore. So, and so, you know, I get people, and because I've been on telly, you know, people come up and go, you know, that jacket that you had on Newsnight. And if you're on, you're talking about really deep, you know, serious stuff. And they go, we thought it made you look a bit washed out. And the other one, and then this really, really makes me laugh, is people who come up to me and say, do you know, the BBC have got really good makeup artists. You go, yeah, they do. And they go, because they're really good, aren't they? Because you don't look like that in real life. And it does make me smile because people aren't meaning to be rude. You're in their living room. They've seen you. They've made a judgment and they feel that they want to come and tell you. So they're treating you like family. So actually there's something I think is really kind of quite warm about that, because they're not coming up and going, you, and load of swear words. They're treating you as someone that they care about. And it really does make me laugh. So I'm really sorry. So especially if it's about something I've worn, I have this imaginary person where I just go, I know they made me wear it. I know. It was horrible, wasn't it? But they were so nice to me. And I didn't want to say, because they'd got me whatever. And it's obviously something I've bought. You know, I don't have wardrobe. You know, I don't have people buying my clothes, mate. You know, so I kind of have this imaginary person. Like, they were so nice. And they really liked it. And I didn't want to, you know, hurt them. So, no, you're right. And so, because you again, in that, so you can't say, well, I really liked that. I thought I looked great in it. So but every time, and that happens fairly regularly, you know, different ways. It does make me smile because I think that they see me as family, and that's really quite sweet.
Well, you see, I think that's so sweet because you are internally reframing, and that is, I think, part of a characteristic of a successful person is they are seeing the best in it. And if there is no best in it, they reframe it to make it work for them, or at least not affect their psyche, so that they can easily brush it off, which is what humour is, isn't it? It's like, you know, when people say, why can't you see the funny side? I think what you do so successfully is see the funny side all the time, if at all possible.
It also comes from the position I am and what I do. You know, I think, you know, my best friend, if someone went up to her and said, your makeup looks horrible, she would react in different ways, because that's kind of personal. So I think some of it's this. So I've got sort of different versions of me. You know, I've got the me that was an athlete, the me that's mum, the me that's parliamentarian, the me that's politician. You know, there's different bits of me who all come together in one person. And I don't kind of sort of go out to go, oh, today I'm going to be this. I'm not kind of creating this image of myself because it's me. But people might only see one bit of the... So I sort of say I'm a Venn diagram. People might only see one bit of the Venn diagram. And this comes back to my parents. They were always very keen. I did not identify myself just as an athlete. My dad was like, you're not just an athlete. And that's actually, being an athlete's a bit boring. That's the most boring part of you. Because, you know, you turn up and go, what do you do today? Well, I went training. And it's really dull. So my parents were a really important part of that in helping me see myself as a Venn diagram, but also understanding people only saw little bits of me.
That's fascinating, because we're talking about how that we can mould people to have a resilient attitude. And what you've just described is that your parents had that ability to help you mold yourself, to have that sense of humour about things, but not see yourself just as one thing.
I think especially in sport, where you have a very limited life, you know, and I retired at 37, so I kept going for quite a long time. I mean, I probably hit my peak at 34 and then went downhill quickly, but, you know, it is not a lifelong career in most sports. There's some sports where you can keep going a bit longer, but, you know, it's, so I think in terms of how my career was framed, at the end of every season, my dad would say to me, so what are you going to do when you grow up?
Oh, you know, lovely.
And then even, you know, so when I went into the House of Lords, I remember ringing my dad and saying, like, I'm in, I've got the confirmation. And he was like, yeah, it's not a real job though, is it? Yeah, your sister's got a real job because she's a nurse. And but he didn't, you know, he's like, yeah. And it was that bit where it was like, I was so excited because it's quite an arduous process. And it was just that bit to just go. And then he's like, yeah, so what are you going to do? What? So, you know, I find that kind of lovely that my family are supportive, but use kind of humour to help me. Because you get big up in sport, you get big up and big downs.
Sure.
And it's how you navigate through to lessen those sort of bumps. Same in politics. You can win, you can lose, you can have great days, you can have days where you feel like you're smashing your head into a brick wall and you get nowhere and nobody listens to you. And there was a big bit of legislation I was doing, and I was in charge of the votes, and I basically lost 4 votes in a row. And I remember feeling really demoralised, and this was about support for disabled people. And I remember ringing home and just like, how do I tell my family that we've lost the votes? And Harris was only little at the time, and she answered the phone and she said to me, Daddy's made me watch the Parliament Channel. So I was like, oh, okay, right. And she said, you're not having a good day, are you? So I said, no, I'm not, no. And she went, but we still love you. Oh. You're like, oh. And there's one bit of you goes, really? That's, and the other bit you go, it's my baby. So, you know, you have those moments where you need that kind of reframing.
I love that. And I also, what I really love is that whole thing, which seems inherent in how you were brought up and hopefully how you're bringing Caris up, is that teasing element, which is what I call humour as well, that light teasing. I spent 2.5 years training doctors at Guy's King's and St Thomas's, and while we were there, King's did a research paper into how quickly, it's relevant because your sister Sian's a nurse, how quickly nurses got patients better. And the ones who had humour, who could tease, cajole, play, got their patients to leave in half the time and got them to the place. And so there's a real art to that whole teasing. And I think, going back to what we were talking about, resilience, if you can be teased and play as you're growing up with people, that gives you the ability to be more resilient. Do you think that's true?
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Yeah, I think because you have to kind of look at yourself. And I mean, there's definitely people that I wouldn't joke with in work. I think in a work environment, it's different. Or, there's people who I don't think are funny and they don't think I'm funny and you just wouldn't try and be jokey with. Mm-hmm. And there's some people I would. I know it's interesting when I'm doing kind of, so, you know, some of my work is paid speaking work. And, you know, people's reaction is like, oh, I didn't think you were going to be funny. And there's some bits of that I talk about which are kind of funny because actually it helps me through, it helps them through. Some bits are really funny. Well, I think they are. You see, I don't see this myself, but it's been said to me quite a lot of times when I'm doing my speaking work, oh, you like Victoria Wood. And it's like, and it's been said to me like lots and lots of times over the years. And it's like, I can't see that in myself at all. And you think, well, I might do better if I was sort of Victoria Wood Mark II than the career I've chosen. But it's kind of interesting how people connect you to comedians. But also there's an assumption, because you're an athlete or you're a politician, you can't be funny, you know. And actually there are really some, you know, funny politicians.
I thought when you were talking about it, I've seen your keynote speeches and they are excellent and really funny. And the highest praise you can get is somebody saying Victoria Wood, because she was a comedic genius.
Yeah, I know. I mean, it's amazing. I mean, you kind of, those things where you come away. I mean, to be honest, it feels, the time I find it hardest to have feedback is if I've done a speech online, because there's a bit where I think people kind of have to say you're really good. So, because I can't go, oh, that was a bit rubbish. That's probably the hardest one to take, you know, or to deal with, because I kind of go, are they just being nice, or are they being real, or are they being whatever? So but the chance to kind of do those things, I'm incredibly lucky with my career. I get a chance to do loads of different stuff. And that's a really nice place to be as well.
I saw your fabulous speech, Seize the Day, which is also the title of your autobiography. And it's fabulous. And I thought when I saw it, I have a theory, Tanny, that the difference between a good speaker and a great speaker is humour. Because I think you can be certain amounts of inspiration, but I think you take an audience on a completely different journey if you can introduce humour and lightness into it. Do you agree?
If you're doing something, however long the presentation is, you know, whether it's, you know, 10 minutes or half an hour, 45 minutes, you've got to have those sort of bits with it. Because if you just deliver something, it's either got to be incredibly intellectual and this massive learning curve that, you know, people are desperate for the information. You know, my job is to go in and do the lighthearted, you know, it's not to deliver business messages. It's to enforce the things that are happening around the conference, to get people to kind of link the business messages and, okay, this is what I learned in my life, to kind of help people make those connections. But, you know, even with some of that, I've had some funny ones. It was like, and anyone in the speaking world's had it probably, you know, I had a call very late Thursday night saying, can you be in Birmingham tomorrow? The speaker's just dropped out. And it's like, oh, okay, yeah, I can. And they're like, yeah, because we've rung everyone else we can think of and no one's answering their phones. And you go, yeah. And I remember saying to this one agency, well, what do you want me to talk about? And it's someone I know reasonably well. And she basically went, we don't care. You can do whatever you want as long as you're in Birmingham at this time and you do 45 minutes.
Oh, nah. No.
And so, I... and, And then they said to me, oh yeah, do you know, name your fee? And it was like, no, I'm just, it is what it is. And they were like, you serious? And it was like, this is the point you could have doubled. And like, no, I'm fine. I'm all right. Thank you very much. So there's some funny bit, but I love that one. Yeah, we've rung everyone else we could think of. But you go, well, do you know what? Well, at least I was on the list.
Yeah. Yes.
No, I'm sure. So the question I never asked was, how long is the list? Never asked that.
You don't want to know, do you?
No.
It's like the old gag is, how many speakers does it take to screw in a light bulb? 10. 1 to screw in the light bulb and 9 to go, that should have been me up there.
You see, that's good. Yeah. It's a funny world, the speaking world.
It is.
I once, this is completely random. I once turned up for a speaking gig and I don't have a rider. Why would I have a rider? And it was an agency that I hadn't done anything with before. And I got there and they're like, we've got everything that you wanted. I'm like, well, I don't. And it was literally, you know, so many cans of drink facing this way and so many sweets red. And it was like, I don't have a rider. And it was an agency that do kind of a lot more acting, sort of theatrical, music-y stuff. And then I said, can I have a look at this? And then basically they were so incensed that I didn't have a rider that they made one up for me. and it wasn't quite Mariah Carey proportions. It wasn't far off. And then I remember at the end of the, actually, this is one proud moment where they went, we thought you were going to be, I won't use the word, it's very difficult. And you weren't. I was like, literally, give me some warm coffee. I'll be all right. I'm fine.
Yeah.
No, but it kind of was very, yeah, everything was lined up for me. That was very funny.
It always reminds me of Spinal Tap. Have you seen the film Spinal Tap? They're, you know, when he's got the meat and the little bread and he's going, I don't want this. I don't know. Anybody who's seen the film will understand that. You were talking about that ability to stand outside yourself and think how ridiculous. Do you think that in order to be successful, whether that's in sport, in the House of Lords, or in life generally, you have to be able to laugh at yourself?
I know people who are very successful who certainly don't give the outward appearance at laughing at themselves. Mm. Very serious. I think you have to have self-awareness. I do. I mean, there's probably people I know who don't have much self-awareness either and very successful. But I think in kind of the world we're in now, you do have to have the kind of a degree of self-awareness about it. I'd say most people I know do have the ability to kind of look at themselves and just go, do you know what? It's because actually it's about how you get through stuff as well. It's how you cope with stuff. So, you know, if you don't have the ability to find humor or to look at things in a different way, I think it can drag you down. I think it can. But maybe that's just kind of the people I know and I've linked with and I've associated myself with. And, you know, I don't expect people to be laughing at themselves all the time. But it comes back to what I said before, that kind of humour does sort of attract me to people.
You talked about, you know, the seriousness of some people and in some situations, and obviously that's appropriate in certain times. But do you think humour should be valued in business and in, you know, in work generally? And do we laugh enough is really the point?
We probably don't. I mean, we've probably all been on like horrendous away days, team building courses, where you kind of all get thrown in together and it's like, and then I've been on ones that are brilliant where you actually do laugh and you have fun and you bond and you get to know different things about people and it's really useful. I don't think we do. It comes back to what's this line, and it's different, I think, in the real world and in the business world. You can't, you know, in sport, a lot of stuff has been excused with banter. You know, it's banter. Like, no, it wasn't really. Yes. So, you know, the squad I was in, I would say we had a lot of banter, but it was the right side of. But then I don't know necessarily how other people took that. I remember doing a training session with Dave Weir, who's like one of the fastest men in the world, and we were doing starts again. And basically, you know, he would just beat me hands down. And he was trying to help me. And then in the end, it was like, right, you start 5 metres back from me and you push with one hand. and then see how long I can stay away from you, you know. And I remember him just looking at me and just going, and you know, but there's humour in lots of different ways. So yeah, I think you've got to be careful about where it slips into banter and the wrong humour. But banter can be brilliant at its best, you know. It's fab, you know. But yeah, I think we're probably all a little bit more aware of some of those things. But I do think for me, humour keeps me going, and you know, that's, and it sometimes it can be laugh out loud, and sometimes it can just be a look. You know, that, you know, I'm not very good at sort of, I wish I could do that one eyebrow raise, you know, that.
There you go.
But, you know, but sometimes it can just be like.
Yeah.
You know, that's sort of like, yeah. That, and you just go, yeah.
You studied politics at university.
Hmm.
Did you have any ambition to go into politics before sport or competing on that, or was it a complete surprise afterwards?
But I had no ambitions at 21 to go into politics. I wanted to be an athlete. I thought my plan always was to do law conversion. So it was kind of being that space. And as I kind of went through my time competing and everything else that I was doing, I kind of realised politics and achieving change was something that really mattered to me. So apparently there was someone who'd said to my dad when I was 21, she's going to end up in the House of Lords. I don't remember that conversation. My dad did. But so it was the Lord Lieutenant of Cardiff who said that to my dad. And yeah, I think it was probably where I was going to end up. I just didn't see it. But I think I made decisions along the way. You know, I knew when I retired from sport what I didn't want to do. You know, I'm not a reality TV type of person. You know, I know what I'm not good at, mostly. So, you know, I think it's very hard when you're an athlete, when you retire and you get kind of offered things and you get shoved in a certain way, and it's very hard to dial back from that. So I think I was really conscious again from being in my 20s, whatever career I sort of decide to do, number one, you've got to commit to it and you've got to take it really seriously as you take training and sport and all that. But also, if you go down certain routes, it's quite hard to pivot. Some people do it really well. I knew that I couldn't, you know, for lots of reasons. So, you know, it was about putting the building blocks in place to think about what next career step was going to be.
It's just very interesting because you're now a crossbench peer and at a very interesting, shall we just say, time in politics. So can humour start to bring people together and find some common ground?
It can do. I mean, there's a bit of context around that. I mean, I think there's, this is an Alan Partridge quote. Well, I can't, it's not an Alan Partridge, but they use it. Funny peculiar or funny ha-ha. And I think that's, you know, I think language can be very helpful. And I think in certain circumstances, humour can as well. At points in politics at the moment, I'm struggling to find humour in the situation. Sometimes there may be humour in, not in people as in a sort of mean way, but I think, that sometimes in politics it's very hard to find the humour. But then it's kind of interesting when you look at people in Parliament, it can be quite a happy place to work, even though, I mean, there's lots of levels to this. In terms of, you know, you will quite often see peers and MPs walking around, smiling, talking to each other, you know, just kind of finding a way through. I mean, that's not true all the time. You know, it's a very mixed bag and depending on the day and what we're doing and everything else. So we've got this thing in Parliament and it's actually really good. It's called Long Table, where you go for a meal. So if you haven't got anyone to sit and eat with, you have to take the next free seat. And you can sit with a whole range of completely and utterly, you know, different people that you would potentially never normally talk to. And that can quite often be quite humorous because you might politically massively disagree with the person you're sitting opposite. And you might, probably the fact you're there at the same time, you're probably working on the same bit of legislation. So having a different conversation, which is not about the business of the day, kind of gets you through, especially, you know, where we do some late nights, you know, especially when you're grabbing something to eat at 7 o'clock and you know you're going to still be in the building at 2 o'clock in the morning, you know. So those moments do matter.
You know, I like the idea of long table is actually fabulous to me, and because it forces people to stop factionalizing and sort of, you know, getting into their own mindset. And also, doesn't it therefore humanize your, in inverted commas, enemies?
I mean, we also have a lot of rules in the chamber, you know, so you can't say you can't point, you can't, there's lots of things you can't do. You have to call people by their titles. This is where language in Parliament's really interesting. So if it's a fellow crossbencher, you're meant to call them my noble friend. And you can do it, my noble friend. You can do my noble friend. My noble friend. Or you don't call them my noble friend. And so there are these moments that are, and again, it comes back to House of Lords funny or real world funny.
But when it goes into Hansard, it will always read the same.
Yeah, so, you know, there are moments where there are some speakers in the chamber who are just brilliant orators, who know how to deliver and know how to know what tone to take and how to pick it up, drop it down, and know how to do all those different things. That is a massive skill. And I don't think that skill is necessarily appreciated that much, knowing that skill of you know, how to read a room. You know, that's a really big skill to have.
You've talked about how important it is for people to listen, especially, you know, I think I heard you say once that what was the most important thing that you wanted when people were dealing with you? And it is to actually listen to what you're saying rather than just interpret what you're saying. But that reading a room is about listening, isn't it? And in psychology, we call it listening off the top. So you notice the body language. People, you know, I noticed that when I was talking about this, you just leant in. That's... Yeah. A part of the listening process, and is that what makes people better as orators as well?
I've seen some people learn it and be very effective, and then some people who aren't, in terms of that, you know, being a good orator. There are some people you sometimes expect to be better than they are, but I think you can learn to be better. I think it's about having a vulnerability to an extent, and putting yourself in the position where you practice, you learn, you get better. I don't think you can just go on. Yeah, you can go on a course and you can learn lots of things, but you've got to make yourself quite vulnerable to be better, because you get improving it. But then I see some people who just can nail it, and then others who develop it over time. But I think you can. I think it's always interesting, the ones who want to be better and want to learn. If you ever listen to someone who just doesn't think they have to improve anything, then it's like, okay.
But that's what I think of is listening to properly is the feedback you're given. Because if everybody in the chamber, for instance, is crossing their arms and leaning back and sort of yawning when you're oblivious to it, then you're not learning, are you?
No, and it's knowing when to sit down. So, Lord Heseltine's made a couple of speeches recently. I think he's 90. He did an incredible, like, 11-minute speech, no notes, so we're very lucky we get to listen to something. Whether you agree with him politically or not, it's the quality of the speech. So, you know, there's something I've been working on for 7 years, and on and off for those 7 years, I thought about, okay, if we ever get a chance to debate this, I need an amazing speech. And on and off, I've been thinking about, if I said this, well, okay. You know, and you're not thinking about it every other day, and then you have a bit more time, you go, well, if I said that, and I'd kind of worked out, and I'd written what I still think is one of the best speeches I've ever written. In the moment, I didn't need to give it because people agreed in the chamber it was the right thing to do. And it's knowing at that moment to go, I'm not doing it. I'm just going to look at the minister and nod And there's a bit you come out going, but that was a really good speech. It was amazing. Oh, well, I think it was, whether any, it was kind of quite challenging. But you go, it's kind of, and I still think it was the right thing to not, and I might, I'll need it again. It's that there will be a version of it that I will use. But there's a few things where in Parliament, you've got one chance to do it. You can't do a brilliant speech and then use it again, you know. And so it's knowing when you've got that, that is the most optimum time to use it. There was no humour in it. But, you know, it's sometimes, it yeah, that awareness is really important. Knowing when to sit down. No, you know, somebody said to me, don't go and speak in a debate where you're not an expert, because there'll be 40 people in the chamber who are an expert. So, you know, just it's knowing when to speak up, it's knowing when not to, and knowing when to just step away.
It's knowing when to hold them. It's knowing when to fold them. It's knowing when to walk away. It's knowing when to run. to paraphrase the old song. This is an aside slightly. I was right backstage by the People's Vote rally when Lord Heseltine, Michael Heseltine, was making the speech. And there had been a whole succession of speeches, and all great parliamentarians, all making great speeches. And I wrote on my social media that Lord Heseltine made the best speech of the day. And it was. It wasn't read. It was just off the top of his head. And it was extraordinary. And I was amazed that some people who didn't agree with his politics, which I don't particularly myself, in certain things, were having a go at me and saying, you can't say that. Because, and I'm going, it was just reporting. It was the best speech.
I love listening to people who are good speakers. Well, like, why wouldn't you? I mean, who wants to listen to speakers who are rubbish or not very good? But I like listening to someone who I disagree with on probably reasonable amount of politics, and then go, okay, I need to listen to what they say. That's, you know, that's good. And, you know, the chamber's really interesting because depending who you are, you get leeway. There are brownie points that you get in the chamber, and people build up brownie points or they don't, you know. And, you know, Lord Howe, Geoffrey Howe, was one of those people that people listened to him. If he wanted to talk for 20 minutes, people would listen. And there's other people, you know, a lot of stuff we do is like time allocated. You have it's called advisory time. It might be 5 minutes. Some people, they get to 4 minutes and 49 seconds and it's like, okay, sit down now. Other people, you know what? Just carry on.
Well, it's interesting that you talk about that, because you are a wonderful speaker and inspirational. A lot of our listeners, you know, panic about speaking. It's the number one fear in the world, public speaking. What one piece of advice would you give to anyone who has to get up to make a speech?
I think it's like, know about yourself. Know if you've got to read it word for word, and know if you, you know, just have point, you know. So practicing is really important in that. There are some speeches I write word for word because they're very technical. Other ones, I was in a debate recently, it's about sport. I had a series of points, know my time limit, go. It's hard to practice. It's hard to put yourself in that vulnerable position. But definitely, I've become a better speaker the more I do it. The other thing, as an athlete, that you have an opportunity to do is go to loads of schools. And that's what I say to athletes, go to schools. Because, my goodness, they're a tough order.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
I mean, you know, you've got a bunch of primary school kids. I was laughing with my husband about it yesterday, actually, saying that we'd gone, he doesn't come many places with me. He'd happened to come to this school visit. And he was sitting in the background while I'm talking, because we were going somewhere together after. And after a bit, this kid put his hand and went, who's he? And I was like, oh, that's my husband. And then the teacher was like, oh, any other questions? And this kid went, are you going soon? I think a lot of my humour has been developed. Oh, do you know, all right, there's a really sweet one where I've had a giraffe named after me at London Zoo. That is so cool.
Congratulations.
And I made the mistake of the first thing I said to these primary school children is, I've had a giraffe named after me in London. So, and then it's like, miss, have you got a dog? No. Have you got a cat? No. Got, no. And, you know, the third time someone says you've got a cat, you can't say to a seven-year-old, I've told you I've not got a cat. You go, no, I don't have a cat. So, you know, actually, very good political training. Very good.
Yeah.
And then the youngster at the end sort of stood up to do the thank you speech. Very serious. He had it written out. He read it all out beautifully. And then his final comment was, and I think we'd all agree, it'd be better if your giraffe had come instead. And so I cry really easily when I laugh. So I'm trying not to laugh because it was so funny. And then I'm trying not to, and like the tears are starting to come. And he's like, don't cry, don't cry. I'm on a neutral face. And then I couldn't do it. And I'm there and I'm going, so I sort of kind of, I'm crying a bit now and I sort of coughed a bit. And then I just, oh, terribly sorry. I'm coughing. I think I'm going to sneeze, you know. And the head teacher was like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. That was really funny. And it was, and I'm trying not to laugh at this because he said what he thought. He genuinely thought it'd be better to have the giraffe than me.
No.
And it's like, you know what? At that age, I probably said the same. So a long answer here, but practice, you know, go to situations where you can try stuff out. You know, if you can, because that's the way to get feedback.
I just love that story. It's out of the mouths of babes.
It amazes me how many people in business who are really high level in business are frightened about speaking.
Yes. Oh, I train people all the time, and some very, very high level people all over the world. And it's astonishing. It's like the Jerry Seinfeld quote, you know, when they showed the list of the top 10 things, the top 10 fears in the world, and speaking in public was number one. And he goes, that's not what worries me. What worries me is that death is number six. Anyway, Tanny, we could talk all day, but we've reached the point in the show which we like to call quick fire questions.
Quick fire questions.
Who is the funniest business person or sports person or somebody who isn't a comedian who you've met?
I do some stuff with Sean Fitzpatrick, ex-New Zealand rugby captain. He's someone that we might not see each other for ages, but when we see each other, we drop back into that kind of, like, you know, relationship. And he makes me smile. So probably not laugh out loud funny, but he kind of picks me up, you know, and he's always a sensible person to speak to. And he's funny. He's good to have around. I mean, especially some kind of sort of, you know, some of the stories and some of the, you know, yeah, just, and he's balanced and just makes me smile. So he's fabulous.
What book makes you laugh?
Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. So it's not like a funny book.
Hold on, is that one book, Tanny? Pride, yes, and Prejudice is. And Zombies.
Zombies.
Sorry, I thought there were two separate books for a moment.
No, so it's basically a rewrite of Pride and Prejudice, but there are zombies in there. And I love kind of classic literature. You know, I did A-level English. I kind of love those. I mean, they're not kind of funny books, but it's that kind of language of the time, but then they all go off and fight zombies. And so it does not laugh out loud, but it just makes me smile, the complete idiosyncrasy of the tone and, you know, that kind of style with zombies thrown in.
I'm going to look it up because just the title alone is brilliant. What film makes you laugh, Tanny?
Mike Bassett, England manager. So I think I know all the lines in it, but it's just daft.
We're going to take a shift to the other side quickly and ask a question. What's not funny?
Violence against women. For me, that's the line. There is, I personally don't find anything funny in rape jokes. No, that is my line in the sand.
What word makes you laugh?
Bottom. Thank you for laughing. Bottom. It's just like bottom. I don't know. It feels like, kind of, I don't know, it's not even a bad or a naughty word to say, but I think it's just the way you can put so much emotion into it. You know, I don't know. It just... Sorry.
You're just thinking bottom now, aren't you?
Bottom. Yes, just sit your bottom. You can. I think it's because you can kind of go, sit your bottom down, you know, where you can kind of sort of be quite sort of out there with... But yeah, I don't know why.
What sound makes you laugh, Tanny?
Other people laughing hysterically and crying for something I don't find funny. So, okay, this is... So we're... I can't even remember what we're watching together. Ian found it hysterically funny. He is crying with laughter. I'm like, that's not funny. But then I was laughing and I couldn't stop laughing at him crying.
It's very convoluted, but it's like, I get it.
Hiccups as well make me laugh.
Do they?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, because it's not someone's fault, is it? But if someone's got hiccups, I laugh. Sorry.
Penultimate question. You've got a very good education. You're in the House of Lords. You're a thing. Would you rather be considered clever or funny?
That's a really hard one. I any day of the week you ask me this, I could change my mind. I think I'm going to say funny, because you have to have to be funny and to be able to know the room, you've got to be clever. So I'm copping out of it, really. So I'm basically giving you both.
No. I think that's completely valid, because I think I've never met funny people who aren't clever. But the other way round, I have met plenty.
Yeah, I mean, I remember watching various TV programmes with Karis, my daughter, and you go, oh, yeah, they went to Cambridge. Yeah, they went to Oxford. They went to, you know, oh, gosh, they only went to Exeter. No, I'm just, you know, it's a lot of funny people are very clever, because it's the bit with humour, it's about that line and being smart enough to know what side of the line you are.
Finally, our final question, Tanny. Desert Island Gags, you can only take one joke with you to a desert island. What would it be?
How would you identify a dogwood tree? By its bark.
Lovely.
Jokes. I can never remember.
You talked about kids, working with kids. That's the perfect kids joke.
Ian is horrendous at dad jokes. Absolutely. Just makes me roll my eyes. So I sort of smile, but try not to smile. And then at some point you go, that is really stupid. But yeah, I think for me, it's probably more one-liners. My favourite Alan Partridge quote is funny peculiar or funny ha-ha. And then, I mean, this is not funny at all. I use this quite a lot. It's like a gift that keeps giving. But when something is really hard and really challenging and someone says, how's it going? And you want to go, so, if it keeps giving. And that you see, that makes me smile, because through really challenging situations, that's my bit of humour that keeps me going with stuff.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for being a wonderful guest on the Humorology podcast, Tanny Gray-Thompson. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
The Humorology podcast was hosted by Paul Barros. Produced by David Rose. Music by Steve Hayworth. Creative direction by Les Hughes. And additional research by Helen Sykes. Please remember to subscribe, like, and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. This has been a Big Sky.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.